The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We have been talking in recent programs about the invertebrate animal phyla. The programs took a direction I really would not have predicted when we began, but we had talked at some length about the, in the minds of the evolutionists, difficulties of trying to connect all of the variety of organisms that we see into one or few or a great many different, the variety of them into a few common ancestors. And the difficulty of having a common ancestor that would then diverge off into all sorts of directions. And it's, as a consequence of that, we have spent some time looking at the invertebrate animal phyla and simply looking at some of the characteristics for them, then pursuing what in my mind is not just a difficulty but an impossibility of that collection of characteristics being able to be brought into existence in one organism when in fact it had come from ancestors that are very, very different. And I have been in something of a dilemma. When you attempt to discuss these organisms, the invertebrate zoologists have a vocabulary all their own. And it'd be very easy to spend all our time in technical terminology, which the average person who listens to the program simply would have no concept about. And on the other hand, simply ignoring some of the technicalities of the structures. I have tried to hit some kind of a happy medium between those. I am really not sure how well I have succeeded. At any rate, of the 10 major animal phyla, we have talked about 8 of those. And we've finished up on our last program a discussion of the annelids, the includes the earthworms, and our last program we had discussed the leeches. And we're left now, I say 8, we've covered 7. There are 3 phyla that we need to talk a little bit about. The echinoderms, the starfish, are one which we will begin discussing today. Then the arthropods and the vertebrates. And although I am quite partial to the arthropods, being an entomologist, I'm not sure how interested everybody else is, so we will try and not bore folks to tears. But there are some things that are quite interesting, interesting as problems for the evolutionists involving the arthropods. And it is at least my intention presently not to spend a great deal of time in the vertebrates. We could spend a year or longer just discussing those. And I think it probably would be, we could spend our time better doing something else. So we're going to talk about the starfish, the phylum Echinodermata. The echino has to do, the literal meaning is simply spine, and the name then means spiny skin. Those of you who live anywhere around the ocean undoubtedly have seen starfish. There are 5 major classes of organisms in this phylum. The starfish themselves, the Asteroidea. There are brittle stars that are known as Ophiuroidea. There are the Echinoidea, which are the sea urchins. Holothuroidea, those of you that live near the ocean will recognize these as sea cucumbers. And the crinoids that are known as sea lilies and feather stars. And each of those classes, the organisms in each of those classes, are very different from the others. And the notion that somehow they were all connected to a common ancestor is simply inane in my thinking. Now, we talked early in the series of programs that one of the advantages or disadvantages of the theory of evolution, depending on your viewpoint, is not that it can't supposedly explain things. The point is it can explain anything. You may use that theory to try and describe and thereby, in the minds of some, explain any kind of oddity that you want to talk about. And I think this is particularly apparent when we start talking about starfish. When I teach invertebrate zoology, among other things, I require that the students learn the unique characteristics for the individual phyla. And that usually is not difficult, although there are one or two phyla where you don't have just a single unusual characteristic, but you have to put two or three together to understand why organisms are put in that phylum rather than a different one. But in the case of the echinoderms, almost everything about them is unique. And even in the minds of the evolutionists, there are some difficulties with the evolution, which we'll talk about. Now, I would assume most of you who've seen the common starfish probably has five arms. And that, again, depending, that may be the only kind you've seen. There are others that have different divisions. There are some that regularly have a dozen. There are some that have up to 24. The size varies. We have one in our collection at school that is about, the central disc on it is probably 8 inches across, and the arms stick out from there. So they are a varied group. The asteroidea, the starfish themselves, are an interesting group. But when you start looking at the characteristics of them, there is no possible other organism that these things could have derived these from. Now, it might be a good time here to remind you listeners of something else we've talked about before. It's one thing to look at an organism and see the structures that are there. It's another thing entirely to have some comprehension of how those structures came into existence. Now, there was a time when we spent a fair number of programs talking about the genetic material in organisms, the chromosomes, the genes that are present that are actually the directors of everything that occurs in the organism. And a single organism receives half the genetic material from one parent, half from the other parent, and these halves then pair up in the cells and collectively are giving instructions to the organisms to produce whatever those structures are. The point I want understood here simply is that it is not possible for any organism to have a structure without having the genetic material that gives the body instructions about how to form it and maintain it and use it. And when we're looking at organisms that are as diverse as these things are, where there is no possibility of any kind of common ancestor for them, it simply means the adhering, I think blindly in some cases, to the notion that the only possible answer to this has to be evolution of some kind, and simply rejecting the possibility that an omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient God could create. One of the first major subjects that we spent time on was the subject of creation, and I'm certainly not going to go back and rehearse all that was said there. For those of you that may be new, I am an adamant creationist. I believe, according to the Scripture, in light of what the Scripture tells us, in light of what we see, that God has given to us a revelation about how He brought into existence those things that we see. I'm not defending that here. I'm simply letting some of you know what my position is. And so, if we have any suitable information about how things came into existence, it obviously would have to be given by an entity, a being, that was present at the time it occurred. And this, of course, means that the only possible source of information about the origin of anything would have to be from the God who made it. If evolution occurred, we don't have any information about that. There wasn't anybody around to see what was going on for the first 99 parts of the time frame that the evolutionists use. So we look at those of us who accept the Scripture as being authoritative and trustworthy, then simply look at the organisms that we're able to find in nature, and at least to some degree attempt to think God's thoughts after Him, to look at those things and to marvel at their intricacy, their complexity, the interdependence whether we're looking at an individual organism and the interdependence of the parts of those organisms, or of the interdependence of organisms in nature as a whole. And while I am not a extreme environmentalist, feeling that we are slowly destroying all the organisms and that if we lose organisms, something bad is going to happen to nature, it is true that there is an interdependence between them. And it is also true that man has not been very careful about that, and in some cases has destroyed organisms and interfered in that process to a degree that many organisms which once existed simply are not present any longer. So, with those comments, let's look at the phylum of what, in my mind, are the most unusual organisms that it's possible for you to see. Unusual, in my mind, simply because of the unique characteristics which they have. The textbook, which we used at the university for a number of years in Invertebrate Zoo, in the introduction to the chapter, there is a very interesting comment which I thought might be pertinent and interesting to some of you. The textbook that we use is one called Integrated Principles of Zoology, and the authors are Hickman, Roberts, and Lawson. It is a standard text in use in many places, and it's not different in its outlook from most of them. But there was a comment at the beginning of the chapter on the echinoderms that I found interesting, and I thought I might share that with you. I'm reading here from page 449 in that text, the beginning of chapter 24, and the title of the section is A Design to Puzzle the Zoologist. Now, the fact that the authors are admitting design is interesting to me. I don't know. Many, if not most, evolutionists would argue that what has formed has come without any design or without any designer. And this, of course, has led to a growing movement that we have talked about from time to time, which deals primarily with some of the difficulties of rejecting the idea of intentional design. The comment, let me read the comment again. We're about out of time, but let me get the comment in, and then we'll talk about it a little bit next time. The distinguished American zoologist Libby Hyman once described the echinoderms as a noble group especially designed to puzzle the zoologist. And it was that sentence that caught my mind. If there is any phylum of organisms that will puzzle the zoologist, it obviously is the echinoderms because of their many absolutely unusual characteristics.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.